History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories right there where you live that really need to be told. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we venture down that path, we end up learning so much. We're educated, we're entertained, and often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I know that's going to be the case today as we visit with 97-year-old Bob Otto of Bakersfield, California. In the military, he was a pilot. As a civilian, a longtime teacher. And in his retirement, he's made an impact on so many families in a unique and powerful way. So we're going to hear about all of that, but as always, we want to go back to the beginning. You grew up in a family with six kids?
Yes.
And why don't you tell everybody where it was you were born?
I was born in Merrifield, Saskatchewan, Canada, and moved to Bakersfield when I was 2 years old.
And have you ever been back there to where you were born?
Yes, I have. With my older brother, who was 7 years old when he left the farm.
Well, and I understand there's a pretty interesting method that your older brother used to get to school back when your family was north of the border.
Yes, it was. He had a horse and had 7 miles to go to get to and from school.
Did you ever hear him tell that story and wish you would have had the chance to do that?
No, I never wished to have that opportunity.
Well, and since you've spent almost the rest of your life here in Bakersfield, except for when the government sent you overseas, have you ever wondered how different your life would have been had your family stayed up there instead of here in oil country in Kern County?
Oh, yes. It would have been so much different. We'd still be on a farm. My dad had two sections that he used for wheat farm. I know he was very busy with it, but they would bring a harvesting crew in each year because they would have to cut the wheat and then put it in like a bundle, and then it would stand, and then it would have to age, in other words, dry out a little before the harvester would come in, and then the harvester would come in, and there would be a large crew, and my mom would have to feed all those people.
You know, I've interviewed a lot of guys over the years who they were born in Oklahoma or Arkansas or somewhere back in that part of the country, and they came here during that Dust Bowl migration. But what was it that triggered your family's move to this area?
Well, my mother came down for a visit to her parents, and it was on Christmas Day. My older sister and older brother, my twin sister, and myself were the ones that came down with her on the train.
And what are some of your favorite childhood memories of growing up here in Kern County in the 20s and 30s?
Actually, it'd be going to the rural schools like Petroleum School and Aztec School.
And did you always get along with all five of your siblings?
Oh, never had any problems with any of them, ever.
Knowing what I know about your life since then, and especially how you've used your musical ability in recent decades to make a difference in many, many lives. I guess that gift you got when you were 8 years old was pretty significant for you?
Yes, it was. Very much so. Brand new trumpet. It was really something. Actually, it was a godsend. My twin sister played piano, and my older brother played violin, and oldest brother played clarinet, and it was a musical family, and we'd stand around the piano in the evenings and sing songs such as When the Moon Comes Over the Mountain and so forth.
So that was a requirement in the Otto family? You had to play an instrument of some kind?
No, it wasn't a requirement because my younger sister didn't have any desire to play an instrument, but I was very pleased that they gave me the trumpet because I was able to use it in military and play in, for example, at Ouachita College when we were waiting to be classified, whether you didn't know whether you're going to be a pilot, navigator, or bombardier. Actually, what it was some advanced courses in calculus and so forth, because you didn't know, as I said, whether you're going to be a navigator, bombardier, or pilot. And in my case, I was hoping I was going to be a pilot because I had spent so many years as a pilot.
Yeah, and let's talk about that. We'll come back to your musical talents, and if people want to see and hear your trumpet ability in action, even at age 97, they can find a little video online at hometownheroesradio.com or on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. As for this pilot thing, how far back does that go? How young were you when you became enamored with this idea of flying?
I was going to Bakersfield Junior College, and they had a course by Roy Pemberton here in Bakersfield. The course was taken during your last year of junior college, and it amounted to learning to fly, and that was what I enjoyed very much. So it was a light airplane that we were flying, actually practicing over where I was raised, and it was very much at home in it. You had a cross-country that you took solo, and you had other flights with the instructor, forced landings, etc.
Well, and you mentioned your instructor. And here in 2019, flying is so commonplace. It's ubiquitous. Everybody just about has flown somewhere at some point, not necessarily in the cockpit, but they're used to flying. But can you help us understand here, you know, in the first quarter century of human flight, how big of a novelty or how unique that was?
It absolutely was a novelty at the time. I liked to fly, and when we finished the course here with Roy Pemberton, while you got your private pilot's license, my number at that time was 70736. The Wright brothers had one and two, and I don't know. Roy Pemberton, his number is in my flight book when he gave me my checks for flying, and he was in something like 23 or 2400, which is, they no longer use that system, of course. They use your Social Security number today.
And now, all these years later, I guess we're about 80 years later now. There are probably millions of Americans who have become pilot, but you are one of the first 71,000 Americans to get that license.
That's right.
And you would use it, and you would also be doing some flying for the military. Let me ask you about the time leading up to World War II, because here you've already graduated high school. You're going to college. Did you hear the rumblings that, hey, these other conflicts that are rising up around the world, America may get sucked into this?
Well, first came to my attention when we were living in Whittier, and I remember on December 7th, Sunday morning in at Whittier, and my dad and I were listening to the radio and hearing all of the news about the Japanese bombing Pearl Harbor, and that sort of woke up the world.
How big an impact did that make on you to hear that news?
Very much so, because I was working for Douglas Aircraft at the time, and the military was seeking pilots, and I had a private license at the time, and so I just went into to their program and went on, got a commercial instrument rating and so forth, and then it made it when I was in cadets to go through primary, secondary, and advanced. Well, it was very simple because I already had a pilot's license, a commercial license with an instrument rating.
You mentioned Douglas Aircraft. That's another thing that some people aren't aware of, how much was already being produced before America was in the war, that we were sending certain pieces of equipment over to the British. And of course, it really ramped up after Pearl Harbor. And Douglas wasn't the only aircraft company building planes in Southern California. But what were you doing specifically for Douglas Aircraft?
I was an inspector, what you called a line inspector, like when a wing would, mid-wing would be bolted on and so forth. The inspector was there to make sure and put his stamp on that the torque on the nuts were at the required amount number.
And does that mean that the fact that you were doing that job, does that mean you could have gotten a deferment because of that job if you wanted to?
Oh, yes. But I didn't care for a deferment. I wanted to continue flying.
And one more thing about where you were at that place in time, if we look back now. You mentioned Whittier College, home of the Poets, which is one of the most colorful nicknames in college athletics. But a very small school there in Southern California who had a pretty famous student, probably just a few years ahead of you, huh?
Yes, Nixon was one of theirs. In fact, he lived right across the street from my dad, and I remember a loaf of bread being delivered to my dad instead of to Nixon, and I think my dad took the loaf of bread over to Nixon across the street.
Would it ever have dawned on you that there was a future U.S. president living across the street?
No, it never bothered me in the least. It's just another neighbor.
Well, and can you help us understand how things changed after Pearl Harbor? What were the most significant differences that you saw in that immediate aftermath?
Well, the whole way of life, because the Japanese became an enemy. We had had a family of Japanese on another lease. I guess I can name them. The family was Yamashita. And mother and son, youngest son, Charlie, went back to Japan, and the father, I guess he was getting information on oil production in the United States, and he was sending that information to his, I guess, constituents in Japan.
Well, that's kind of eerie, isn't it? These are people you've been acquainted with all these years, and you never would have suspected, it sounds like.
That's right. You would not suspect them as being detrimental to our way of life.
And if we look back now, with hindsight, we see that 120,000 Japanese Americans were rounded up and stuck behind barbed wire, and the vast majority of them never did anything like that. But at that point, as I understand it, I wasn't there, but it sounds like that suspicion was commonplace, that because there were isolated cases like you're talking about, there was this kind of air or backdrop of suspicion towards a lot of them?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, I have a very close friend who is a pilot, and he was a pilot during the Vietnam War when he lived here. Why, we were great friends, and his family was put in an internment camp, and his dad was also one of the ones that was in Germany, and you've seen the film on the Japanese and what they did in Germany during the war.
The 442nd Regimental Combat Team, the Gopher Broke unit?
I presume that's what it was. I don't recall.
Well, and so you said you didn't want a deferment for working in the aircraft industry or for going to school. You wanted to fly. A lot of guys wanted to be pilots in World War II. Were there some hurdles you had to clear? I mean, I know you already had your civilian pilot's license with the instrument rating, but along that course, going from cadet to actual Army Air Corps pilot, were there some challenges in your way?
Oh, yes. there were hurdles to do all the way along the way.
What were some of the more challenging ones?
Oh, pass the various tests that they had. For example, you had an instrument ride, you'd have check rides, and you would hope that you did well on them. I evidently did. I did have a couple of forced landings. I remember one when we were in primary, while we were flying PT-19, and there were a few, you might say, flights that weren't required by the book, and I was doing what was called a vertical snap roll, and when I finished the snap roll, while the engine quit, and there I was, miles from base, and no engine, so what it is, pick out a field to land in, a forced landing. And I picked one up. It was about a mile square of a wheat land that had just been harvested, and set it down in the middle of the field, knocked on the door of the farmhouse, and the woman glanced, and I had my helmet on, and I had to grab my that and pull it off and let her know that I was a human being. And so then she came to the door, and I asked her if I could use her phone. She said, "We don't have a phone." I said, no one has a phone out in this area. And she says the nearest phone is at an intersection, and it's over a mile away. But she said, I'll go down there and I'll call. So she did. And when she came back, she had a little number 10 can and about three or four ice cubes in it and a Coke in that for me.
Times have changed, haven't they? And you said that was one of the forced landings that you made. Do you remember the others?
Oh, yes. That was when they brought an ambulance out to the field, and I was put in the ambulance to go back, but there was nothing wrong. I did hit my head on the top of the door where the door would close on the ambulance and a bruised head. Other than that, why it all went well.
So I got to get this straight now. So this is the incident where you're out of power after that snap roll. You have to put it down in a field. You knock on the door. There's no telephone, but she brings you a Coke in a can. You're not injured at all.
Oh, no.
Until the ambulance gets there.
No. Well, this was normal because there was a test pilot that came out with the crew and the pickup truck with a mechanic. And the mechanic knew exactly what was wrong with it because he lifted the hood on the side and pulled out a ball peen hammer and tapped on the carburetor and I guess loosened the float where it would move up and down. And the test pilot fired it up and took it off.
The sending an ambulance out was standard operating procedure, but I do believe, unless I'm forgetting someone, I believe you have to be the first person I've ever met who was uninjured when the ambulance arrived and then was injured by the actual ambulance that came to rescue him.
More or less, yes.
And when you look back on stories like that, and aviation, like we discussed, was so primitive at this time, there was so much that nobody knew because nobody had ever done it before. Do you ever look back at situations like that and think, you know, I was maybe in a little more danger than I realized I was?
Yes, I have. I've felt that I was very fortunate all the way through in my flying career to have just a couple of three forced landings, actually, at different times in life and so forth.
That situation back in Texas during training is something Bob Otto can chuckle about now, but there would be more harrowing moments in the cockpit to come, and we're going to get to that. Time for our first break, but head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos and video related to Bob Otto's story, and we'll be right back after this.